There was a cellist, a woman named Jacqueline Dupree. Dupree, I think her name was. I know they made a movie about her life at some point. She was popular many years ago. She was became quite well known quite young and was extraordinarily sensitive and talented as a musician. And then, in the way of this world, at the apex of her career, and she was married to, perhaps it was Zubin Mehta, but I'm not sure, the leader of, I think, the Los Angeles Philharmonic. She developed MS, multiple sclerosis, and gradually, you know, the incredible sensitivity that allowed her to play, she lost it, and she gradually couldn't play at all. I didn't follow her career or knew about her, but there was a recording of a piece, I don't know whose piece it was, who the composer was, but she recorded it, and Swamiji used to love it. And many times in the evening, we would sit and listen to that together, and it was extraordinary, her playing and the piece. So she was an intimate part of my life. And when all that happened to her, you know, you can't help but, even from a great distance, with someone you don't know personally, you walk with them. And you have to think, what if that was me? How would I feel? Many years later, in some context or another, she was interviewed on television, and I either read about it or saw it. And someone asked her, how is it for you not being able to play music anymore? And she was a very unusual woman. And she looked like this, sort of startled. And she said, oh, but the music's still inside me. Isn't that an interesting response? You know, for us, of course, we received it from her. But Swamiji often talks about whatever inspiration or negativity you pass on always has its greatest effect at the source. So whatever she was able to give to us, she also had to be first receiving it. In this context, I was thinking of Swamiji talking about writing the oratorio, this beautiful piece of music about the life of Christ. And it was an interesting turning point in Ananda as a whole also, because even though Jesus had always been on our altar and we would always say Jesus Christ, Babaji, Krishna, because of Swami's more recent experience in India, because in the 70s Swami came away from India in 1962, and what we were recreating at Ananda was very Indian-oriented. We had Indian names, we wore Indian clothes, we did a lot more Indian chanting. And Jesus was there, but he kind of hung out around the edges. And partly because we didn't know how to take him in. All that we had was either Jewish people who had repudiated him, or Catholics who only understood it through Catholicism, and then the sort of bunchy middle of all the others, the Mormons and the Protestants kind of hanging out in there. But none of it made any sense to us in the context of self-realization, so we found it more convenient to ignore it. Then Swamiji took a pilgrimage to Israel, and we began. That was the period of time when we moved to Italy and began to be associated with a group of charismatic Catholics in Italy who were entirely devoted to Jesus, and a marvelous exchange of energy began to take place. The end of which was Swami went to Israel and then wrote the oratorio. And when he put it into music, we many of us felt, oh, finally, we now understand what the vibration of Jesus is. Because the dogmas and the theology and the rituals and all of that, that's not really an actual experience. That's a vicarious experience. An actual experience is when you're in the vibration. And one of those powerful ways, the most direct way to be in a vibration other than in complete silence, is through music. Because it's sound waves, it's om itself, it's what we're made out of. So when suddenly we were singing and hearing these songs that went through the whole chronicle of the life of Jesus and all the extraordinary potential of that. All of a sudden, it was like we had our way. My family is Jewish, and my parents sort of kept in touch with Ananda in various ways, in their own way. And after the oratorio came out, my mother insisted, to her dismay, that we had become Christians. I tried to explain to her that we always were. My mother had a way of, when she decided something was true, she didn't want to be confused by the facts. So she told me what my life was, and I realized it was not worth the effort to dispute her. We had an amusing experience that way. For some reason, I was with Ananda while my parents were living for 35 or plus years, and they went in and out of liking it and not liking it. And when we became Christians, for some reason, it made my mother intensely Jewish. More Jewish than she'd been prior to the time I became a Christian. And she went on this little thing about how, if only they had raised me more deeply in Judaism, because we weren't really raised in it at all, perhaps this thing would not have happened. And once again, I, being so rational, I was trying to give her the facts. And a little voice inside of me said, let her take the blame. So instead of trying to explain it to her, I just agreed with her, oh yes, mother, if only. If only, who knows what might have happened. So she managed to just feel really terrible for a little while and then cheerfully dropped the whole subject and never brought it up again. You never know. You never know where the flow of things is taking us. The only way you can ever really know anything is not with thought and word and even interaction with people, but only through direct experience. And that's where the music comes in. That's where the meditation comes in. That's where actually satsang with one another comes in. It isn't so much when we gather the conversations that we have or anything like that. It's an exchange of vibrations. It's somehow or another, all of us trying to attune to the same thing. When we come together, we're all closer in that attunement. Attunement is very subtle. Attunement is not a good attitude or a willingness to serve or being a talented person or being nice, having a pleasant personality, none of those things. Attunement is where we come to rest when everything else stops, when we stop putting out this big personality. I was going to go back now. I wanted to finish the thought about Swamiji writing the oratorio. Swami said something very interesting about that. He said, he's speaking of himself, my own experience of the presence of Christ was complete, he said. I didn't have to translate it into music, and I didn't have to share it with anyone else. It was already complete. But then, as he put it, it came to me in music. And when he wrote that oratorio, he got many of the melodies. What would happen is he would often wake up with them, or they would just come to him. He would have a little tape recorder, and sometimes he would whistle them into his tape recorder. So the whole oratorio started as a series of little whistled melodies into the tape recorder. And Swamiji knew that in those melodies was going to be this exquisite piece of music. And when he first came back from Israel, Europe, and then in San Francisco, he lived then, he had a room, we had a house, we had a big house on Broadway that we rented for a decade. And Swami had a room on the top floor, and some of us were on the top floor, and he had this little keyboard that was scarcely larger than a big harmonica and sounded about like one. And he wanted to tell us this wonderful thing that had happened. And so he got out this thing, and you know, dee, 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 you know, just lit like this. Dee, 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 dee. And we thought, uh-huh, that's just gorgeous, Swami. Yeah, that's really, and you sort of had to just go along because what he was feeling at all. It was all there for him. Now, in our own spiritual life, you know, we have to be very conscious that what we're really trying to do is we're trying to always find and always live in that vibration. It's not always possible to bring it out. We have very strange personalities, many of us. I have had a woman friend who had a great deal of trouble getting along with people. Just her relationships never seemed to come together right. And an astrologer told her, rightly or wrongly, but it certainly seemed true, you have the karma to appear insincere. That's what he said. So people were always suspicious of her, never took her as she was. Because, of course, where would that karma come from? From having been insincere in previous lives. Having been a flatterer or trying to get things from people, who knows? But the karma was still playing. The heart had changed, but the karma was still playing. Now, in all of our lives, there's a lot of karma sometimes that's still running. But we can't always do anything about the karma that's still running. It's the momentum that we ourselves set in motion. We did it to ourselves, but karma sometimes goes around in a big circle like a boomerang. If you consider you throw it out like this, and it can take incarnations to make that full loop. You know, you throw a physical object and you watch it come back, but you send it that way and it comes back this way. And so over the course of many lifetimes, we send a lot of things out, and they are all tied to us because of our ego identity, because of our karmic lessons. And no matter how long that circle is, they're all going to come back to us. I have my personal theory of karma now. I like to make things as simple as possible. At first, it's very interesting as to who did what to whom and in what incarnation and why I dislike you so much and why you dislike me so much, and all of those details are fascinating. But after a while, they're not. They just distract you and often become a justification. I had an interchange with someone recently who, you know, had a difficult moment, and when we were discussing the difficult moment, a long explanation was given, extremely valid. You know, so-and-so did this, and I responded that way, and so-and-so did this, and I responded that way. Yes, I said, but other people's shortcomings are no justification for your shortcomings. And that's just the truth of it. So after a while, you stop even wanting to know. I feel like all of us mistakenly imagine that we can get what we want at the expense of others. Whether we go at it maliciously or ignorantly, some part of us still values ourselves and our own feelings more than we value others. Or even to put it more kindly, we're conscious of our own selves and our own feelings more than we're conscious of others. But nonetheless, you know, a certain amount of hurt is projected. It's the boomerang we sent out. And it just sort of makes this like a intravenous bag full of hurt, which at certain points God just jams into our veins. And we suffer. And we're just suffering. It's generic, really. We're suffering because we have to balance. And we can't always stop that, even though our hearts may have changed greatly from the time we sent that out. We can't always stop it, because it just has to finish itself. But we can change the way we feel in our own hearts in two ways. One is that we no longer justify our shortcomings on the basis of other people's shortcomings. Yes, you treated me horribly, but that doesn't really make it right for me to treat you the same way in return. You know, we feel justified, but we're not. Self-justification is very, very dangerous, no matter how reasonable. It's just very, very dangerous. I find these letters that I wrote to Swami a long time ago, actually I burned most of them. But I found them, and they were full of long explanations of why I did what I did. They must have just bored the socks off of it. You know, just there I was explaining, thinking it had something to do with anything. It seemed like a good idea at the time. But it wasn't. Because the first thing we have to stop doing is explaining why I'm justified. We just have to stop. And when you finally stop, oh, it's such a relief. I can't say that I have stopped entirely. That would be way overstating it. But in the times when you do stop, because then you only have one problem. You only have the intravenous bag of hurt that has to come into your vein. You're not sending out more. You know, you're just watching that thing empty and not also filling it from the other side. And the other side is, the other thing we really have to learn is to not let anything separate us from our full awareness that God loves us. I've started reading Whispers from Eternity from the beginning, so you're going to be hearing about it a lot over the next year. Get ready. And one of the very early ones just says quite simply, I am your child, we are all your children, naughty or good, we still belong to you. And he almost says it without implying it, and you're stuck with us, and there's nothing you can do about it. I remember at the age of 10, declaring to my parents, I had come under the influence of bad companions at the age of 10, and I actually was influenced by bad companions, but I was a bad influence too. And my parents really wanted to separate me from these great girls that I was hanging out with. And I declared to them that, this is what I actually said, why do I remember this? I did though. 10, and a very small 10 at that, but with a big mouth. I said to my parents, the die is cast. I read a lot of books. I am either a good kid or a bad kid, and there is nothing you can do about it now. Ludicrous on one level, but not really, because I was. I just was what I was, and I knew it. I lived with them. I was small enough for my daddy to carry me anywhere he wanted to carry me, but the die was cast. I was myself, and I knew it. But the part of that also was that whether we're good or we're bad, we belong to Divine Mother. And what Master is telling us in that first, one of those first early whispers, he's trying to get the word across, whether I ask, whether I pray, I demand, because naughty or good, I belong to you, and you have to take care of me. Just like that. You have to take care of me. And if I'm a big problem for you, that's your problem, not mine, basically. And oddly enough, that's attunement. That we don't let anything separate us. That we don't let anything in any way weaken that essential relationship. No matter what kind of a mess I am, naughty or good, no matter what I've done, I belong to you. You belong to me, and you must take care of me. So it doesn't matter. Anything else doesn't matter. And here we are, you know, ending one cycle, starting another, in this illusion of time that we all live through sequentially like this. You know, but take the moment and make the resolution. I will live in the vibration of the divine. I will be in the presence of that spirit. We're going to move ourselves into that with the power of sound. I was referencing the music and Swami putting the inspiration into melody, and Jacqueline Dupre, after she couldn't pick up a cello, the music was still in her. Music is the most direct way to shift our vibration, to get into the Om. And on New Year's Eve, for quite a long time, we've used a couple of mantras, the same mantras we use every Sunday, but longer and deeper and with greater concentration. And what we want to do in a few minutes from now, when we're using and hearing these mantras, you don't want to say the mantra, you don't want to listen to the mantra, you want to become the mantra. Insofar as we are able, concentrate so deeply on every recurring sound that it drives from your heart every desire, that it drives from your mind every thought. There's tremendous power. We're going to be listening to Swami Kriyananda's voice saying these mantras. And he said these mantras with absolute attunement to the power that was descending through them. You know, the inspiration is there, and then it translates. And the sound is the avenue in. And the goal is to be in. Because when you ever find that, even for a moment, you know, it becomes your true north. And all of our spiritual life is to become more and more familiar with what that vibration feels like. And then, yes, we can be serviceful and joyful and wise and all the things that we can be. But the only thing that matters in the midst of all of that is that when we come to rest, where we come to rest is, I belong to you, Lord, and you must help me. Let that be your New Year's resolution. I belong to you, Lord, and you must help me. So.